There will always be a moon over Marin. Wasn't that a nice visit? Don't forget, a psychiatrist is on duty. That's Ned Kennedy's out of San Francisco. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Little different look today. We're in a different studio. I forgot how shadowy it gets if I wear a hat in this studio. Didn't know we were going to be in here. Anyway, Jays were off yesterday. Not much to report. Only the lowest level of the minor leagues played. Buffalo's in action at 11 a.m. today, so that'll be worth keeping an eye on. Chad Dallas starting in that one. Jays down in San Francisco after an off day. They'll play three against the Giants. 9:45 tonight, Yusei Kikuchi against Blake Snell. 9:45 tomorrow, and then a 3:45 getaway day on Thursday before they head to Arizona, their final series before the All-Star break. Let's go down to San Francisco, a man who looks just well too put together and well too rested for 7 a.m. Pacific time. It's Keegan Mathieson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. How we doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Blake. It's all a lie, you know? On this side of the camera, that's where you see the empty cans, the pizza box, but I'll tell a lie for the morning. Good to be here.
What? This is a little inside baseball writer or whatever, but so you have the Seattle series and you have a Sunday getaway day and you have the off day Monday. Do you spend the off day in Seattle or San Francisco?
I always want to get to the next city, unless it's a really, really good city. And I love Seattle, but I want to get to the next place. I've not been to San Francisco in a long time, 6 or 7 years. I've actually never covered a game here.
Wow.
Going back with the Blue Jays. So came in early yesterday, explored the city a little bit, Blake, and then fell asleep on the couch watching Utah Jazz Memphis Grizzlies Summer League.
California
with
classic.
With that Zach Edey ending. I'm an official sicko, I tell you. But I love being here. And baby, let me tell you, the breeze, the temperature, you might not get me back, Toronto. I don't know.
Oh, man. I'll share a little bit about my career in San Francisco. Back in 2019, there was a basketball team called the Toronto Raptors. And they were in California trying to win the NBA championship. I got to spend a bunch of time in San Francisco and Oakland covering that team winning a championship. The morning after, the night the Raptors won the championship in Oakland, I didn't sleep. I wrote like four things. I was at The Athletic at the time. And then morning comes around and my flight home was late afternoon. You have to book it. You had to be careful because there was a potential game seven and things like that. So my flight home's late afternoon and it was like, okay, I could go to sleep at like 6:30 in the morning and try to get a couple hours in. I just walked down to the pier and just like walked San Francisco for the whole day. Just like, I'm sleepy. They won the championship last night. You know, I had a couple beers while I was riding, but I wasn't like, I was not enough to be like in any kind of way in the morning. It was great, man. It's a very good walking city. And to your point, the breeze really makes up for the fact that I imagine it's going to be well into the 80s come game time tonight.
Probably. I'll be suffering later. I think who's with me on this trip? Shai Davidi will be stuck listening to me complain about the heat in an American city yet again. But for now, beautiful. I've got a diner down the street teed up for breakfast. I don't know what more man needs. I've never wanted more in my life than this, I tell you.
And the Blue Jays won a series in Seattle to send you there happy. Okay. Obviously, it would be better if the Jays had won that series and they were now in a position where winning series mattered, really. They remain 8.5 games back of the wild card. They remain with, 2 or 3% playoff odds. However, at least from the perspective of there are still 70 some odd games to play and this team doesn't want to be miserable. We don't want to be miserable. We want to watch good baseball. Pretty fun series in that regard. Like good competitive games. The Jays crowd traveled well. We got the big George Springer moment. How'd you enjoy that series?
I love that. The crowd in that stadium is a highlight every year for me. And to have a crowd going back and forth, playoff atmosphere gets overused and beaten to death in sports. But what a playoff atmosphere means is that there's people in the house going for both teams, and it feels like something other than just another spring training game, a regular season game. And man, that's what it was in Seattle. It was great. You get Blue Jays fans down from the West Coast, many of whom are here to consume at least one beer. It's a beautiful thing. It's a loud, rowdy crowd. And that last game, especially, Blake, was so exciting. I mean, even as the Mariners were coming back in that was just a good ball game. And frankly, I have not covered a lot of those lately. In my job, I don't really care who wins. I care that it's a good game and that there's a good story. If it goes quick and I get home sooner, fine. But a game like that is so refreshing because there's so much happening. There's the scene of the crowd. There's George Springer with his big moment. That's as much emotion as I have seen from George. maybe since he's joined this organization, honestly. And to see all of that play out was refreshing, because a lot of these games lately have been boring. It's been boring baseball. And baseball is a sport that when it's boring, it's real boring, especially for a casual fan. I think back, Blake, to always to those 15 and 16 teams. People didn't just like them because they were good. They liked them because they were chaotic. The games were messy and unpredictable. They had big swings. It wasn't just this incremental 2-1, 3-1 type of deal. They were crazy games. And this was finally a step in that direction. I loved it. One of the most enjoyable series of the season. And it finally felt like something other than just another game to be 9 or 10 games below 500.
Those teams in 2015, 2016 also had the benefit of when you're 8 games under 500, you can't really talk a lot of smack. You can't have a big attitude and things like that. Those teams got to do that as well. Pour one out for Danny Valencia and the his involvement in like one of those games, chirping from the sidelines. And I believe there were some acronyms that we can't use on the radio and things like that. So Jay's a long way from that. Before I did want to talk more about the George Springer moment, and you wrote a great piece about it for BlueJays.com. But wanted your take on this Mariners team. Obviously a Mariners team that 2 years ago swept the Blue Jays in the wild card round. Last year still won 88 games, but didn't manage to get into the postseason. They are 2 games up in the AL West, but man, we've talked so much about the Jays' lack of offensive execution over the last 2 years. That team had 14 runners in scoring position over the final 4 innings in that game on Sunday. They had the bases loaded 3 times over 7, 8, 9, 10 innings and came away with nothing. This is a team we knew had some offensive limitations. But when you look at what Houston's done lately, the fact that, yeah, Texas is far away, but they're still the defending champs and have a payroll, you know, as large as the Jays, if not larger. How confident or how worried would you be, I guess, if you are a Mariners fan right now?
Pretty worried. Man, it's the pitching and a bit of defense approach to this. And we've talked about this with the Blue Jays a lot this year, Blake. But if you are trying to out-pitch and out-perfect another team, you have to play flawless baseball to win that 2-1, 3-2 game. Whereas if you have some offense, you can screw up a few times. But if somebody hits a home run, we forget all about it, and we're talking about a 6-3 win. It's a lot easier. Watching the Mariners has to be a frustrating experience at times. Now, if you are a hardcore fan and you love good pitching, man, oh, man, that's a real fun rotation. But if you are the 95% of fans who are more casual and want to be entertained, good luck. Watching that team strand the bases loaded each of the last 3 innings, it put me in that spot, Blake, where I'm trying to debate with myself. Are the Blue Jays pitchers really nailing this, or does this lineup suck? And it's always going to be a bit of both. I love what the Blue Jays bullpen did there, especially a guy like Nate Pearson having a good moment. But that lineup, it was surprising for me, Blake. I'll go back to the start of the series, because I don't have much time to keep up with the intricacies of other teams in baseball. I know how teams are doing. I know generally if they have a good or bad rotation, good or bad lineup. But looking at the standings, I thought, you know what? Seattle must be going all right. They must be doing okay. And the first day that I looked at the numbers in their lineup, I thought, what the hell is happening here? Like, how is this team where they are right now with barely an OPS over 700? They're a fascinating team. I wish that they would be a team that would go out and do something fun at the deadline instead of chasing, what is it in Seattle, the 54% rule? But we'll see. You got to play perfect baseball when that's your style, and that doesn't happen all that often.
Yeah, 27th in runs per game. That is one spot below the Blue Jays. They have an OPS about 50 points lower than league average. And 27th in runs per game, to give you an idea of, like, obviously offense is important. You got to be able to score some runs. No other team currently in a playoff spot is below 16th in offense. So basically, the playoff standings are not perfectly sorted, but pretty well sorted by offense, other than the Seattle Mariners. So a concern there for them. So on the Jays side, they got some good pitching. We'll talk about some of those pitching performances from the starting rotation, including Yariel Rodriguez. But the big moment on Sunday was that George Springer home run. Again, you wrote a great piece about it for BlueJays.com, for MLB.com. Springer kind of doing the Will Ferrell in old school. What happened? I kind of blacked out there for a minute. Man, it did, again, with the caveat being that they're still 8.5 out. We still got to talk about these games. That was a really fun moment and kind of, you know, a cherry on the last 2-3 weeks here for George Springer, it felt like.
Yeah, he's keeping this going. It doesn't feel like it's just a 2-3 game burst. And it's also another time in this season, Blake, where I know I criticize a lot of moves that are made, a lot of cold streaks for these players. George has lasted almost 3 months. But a couple people were right about this, George Springer and John Schneider among them. And over again, John Schneider said, I believe in George. We've got some data that really shows he's going to turn this around. What data that was, if it was real, I don't know. We'll never know. But it's kind of like the special stuff they drink in Space Jam. You know, sometimes you just need to hear it. But all along, John Schneider was really defiant, really confident that this would turn around. I'm around John Schneider enough and hear him answer enough questions to know when something's being said just because it needs to be said. But he really believed this stuff, that George Springer would turn this around. And he has. And the thing that Schneider said over and over again since then is that George Springer has been the same guy every day. That's the wording that you hear. You've heard it from Ross Atkins as well. I have been around guys who struggle and turn into a different dude. They really let it eat at them. But there are a lot of days where I show up to the ballpark and George Springer is already finishing batting practice before anything even starts. And he is laughing and he's usually singing. He sings for about 50% of his day. It's amazing how much energy he has. But he has kept it light throughout all of this, which is what a veteran knows how to do. If you look at that, sometimes it looks, is this guy taking it seriously? Well, yeah, they are. It's their way of not letting it overtake their entire life. And that's a really fine balance, I think, that I've come to appreciate a bit more over the years doing this. And I think George has nailed that part of it. So credit to him, because 3 months of being one of the worst hitters in Major League Baseball, it would probably get to me. If I was the worst writer in baseball and everybody was talking about it, I'm sweating even thinking about that, right? So credit to George, and a couple people were right about this one. He's been so impressive lately.
Yeah, well, luckily for you, one, you're talented, and two, it's not always a meritocracy on our side the way it is on a baseball field. So there will be that low bar present. Look,
Thank God we do not have analytics. Thank God I can't be measured with a velocity or a number. My goodness.
Yeah, we're all right. We analytics to judge, not to improve. Okay, so look, one of the reasons George Springer turned around is obviously he's such a big UConn basketball fan. He was distracted by four UConn Huskies being in the NBA draft. The NBA draft happens, boom, that's the date he turns it around. Maybe okay. He's just so worried about Donovan Clingan and Steffi Castle and the rest of those guys. But in terms of what has functionally changed, have you been able to get a sense of, you know, what that work looked like? You know, we've seen him at least, maybe this is looking for an answer where they're isn't one, but you know, it seemed like Matt Hagg is more involved with George Springer in the dugout and in prep and things like that. Obviously the ability to get around on velocity has changed. Have you been able to glean kind of what's gone into this other than, hey, a lot of time and a lot of work is finally paying off?
Whenever anything goes well for one of these hitters, Matt Hagg's name tends to come up more and more and more, which is interesting is the word. I will stick to that. And George Springer, with the work that he's done lately, I noticed the swing being a little shorter, a little more direct. And I think this is making me appreciate the difference between trying to hit the ball and trying to drive the ball. You hear Blue Jays coaches and John Schneider a lot call it swinging with intent, which is a bit of a buzzword in its own right. But George Springer is swinging with more confidence right now. He's trying to do some damage, if you will, instead of just slapping the ball over the infielder's heads. He has always been a guy with more power than his numbers show. It often doesn't even show on the screen, Blake, but George Springer is a linebacker. Like, this is a guy, 6'5", big, broad, strong built player. Like, he is one of the most impressive athletes I've been around in this game. He has enough natural power, especially at his peak years, to be hitting 30 plus home runs annually. So when he taps into that, and when he's healthy and he has his whole body healthy, the power's in there. I think you're seeing him take a few more chances now. And when you have a 550 OPS, you're probably thinking, my God, just get me a single. I don't want this to drop to 540, 530. Now that you're on the come up, it's easier for him to take some chances. It doesn't matter if he strikes out once in this game. If he can really make an impact on the baseball and change a game, a three-run home run, it's worth it. So I think you're seeing him freed up both mentally and physically.
Yeah, which is great to see. And yeah, you mentioned the OPS there. It had bottomed out at 566 on June 22nd. It's now up to 672. So 106 points of OPS over like 13, 14 games. And he is almost, again, this is, says way more about the league environment than George Springer, but he's almost back to league average now. Like, he's within another hot week of having a league average hitting season. So, you know, great for George Springer, and also what has become of the game that I love from an offensive standpoint. Let's flip it to the pitching side, Keegan. You wrote a good piece on Yariel Rodriguez coming out of that Saturday start. Two unbelievable starts in a row for him. There's obviously a lot to like from the intensity standpoint. He's, whether he means to or not, like, that is a showman on the mound. He's a lot of fun. This is also, though, what he looks like the rest of the season, and you tell me if you feel differently, feels like probably the most important, hey, what are we going to learn between now and the end of September as far as what does the 2025 roster look like? Like, if this guy looks like this, the starter versus reliever questions are done. You know, you get him up to 100 innings, things like that. Like, is he the most important guy on the roster the rest of the way to figure out?
Has to be. That changes so much. And if he is a legitimate starter next year, that changes the math by 10, 15 million bucks in terms of what the Blue Jays need to go spend. The Blue Jays are going to need to add a starter. My goodness, they're going to need to add some starting depth. They cannot get this lucky every year. Yes, they've had one big injury in a couple of years, Hyunjin Ryu, but there came Ross Stripling to save the day. This time it's Alek Manoah, but they have enough. Yariel Rodriguez is there to save it. Each of the last few years, the Blue Jays have been one or two injuries away, which would be league average health, from things getting real bad in this rotation. We're talking bullpen games, piggybacking left and right. So to have Yariel step in as not just depth, but a guy who looks like he can be a legitimate piece in this rotation is huge, absolutely huge. And the IL stints and the slow buildup earlier in the year, yeah, they were a pain. They weren't ideal, but they seem to have naturally handled the whole workload conversation. He can get into that 100, 110 inning range at this point. That puts him in line next year to get up to 150-ish, which is the new 200, I guess, in baseball. And that's absolutely the best case scenario outcome for the Blue Jays. And then watching him play, going back to what we talked about with the Seattle series, he's my favorite pitcher to watch right now. The flair he has on the mound, the intensity. I will always remember, Blake, that first day he did a media availability with us in Dunedin. Perhaps I had had a late bedtime the night before. And standing in the Dunedin sun that morning, asking Yariel the first question. And when his eyes shot to me, I almost recoiled, like, oh, Jesus. Like, when this guy looks at you, you are intimidated. There's an intensity that vibrates out of him naturally. And that's so truly who he is, and it carries over the mound just beautifully. I love what he brings to the Blue Jays. They could use more edge. I really think they could. And Yariel has got to be part of that. He is, for me right now, along with Horwitz, probably the best story of this season right now.
Yeah, and Spencer Horwitz, another guy who is, you know, probably not to the same degree as Yariel Rodriguez, but changing the accounting of, at least when you're penciling in roster spots for next year, him showing he can capably get some starts at second base. And yeah, and even, hey, playing first so Vlad can play third and Leo Jimenez can play second is a weird configuration on Sunday. But yeah, Horwitz, I mean, the bat is the bat. You and I have talked about Horwitz. I think this is year three of us talking about him as a hitting prospect, but that ability to be, you know, even if it only ends up being 40, 50 games at second base and then your part-time first base DH, whatever, that changes a lot for him, changes a lot for Yariel as well. Another thing you wrote, I'm just playing your hits today. You had such a strong weekend, as strong as the Blue Jays.
I've at least got one reader, baby.
Yeah.
I only need one reader. That's
well,
okay.
And a newsletter subscriber. So I get up today. There's a BlueJays.com Keegan Matheson newsletter in my inbox, and it's about a mechanical tweak Kevin Gausman made last time out. So we're going to see Gausman in Thursday's afternoon game against old friend Jordan Hicks. So maybe not relevant to tonight, but I did want to dive in on that because some of what Kevin Gausman told you about what he, and this is, I love this because, like, obviously Gausman talks really well anyway, but if anyone ever wonders, like, the value of beat people being on the road, like, it really does seem like you guys get more out of the guys and they're a little looser and they talk a little bit more freely about the craft. But Gausman went into with you, you know, what he was looking for with that mechanical tweak. And it's only one game. We've seen him have 10 strikeout outings before and then kind of go back to where he was. But what did you make of Gausman's last start? What did Kevin Gausman make of Kevin Gausman's last start?
I do love the value of being on the road, Blake. Shout out to the haters and the aggregators. But Kevin Gausman, when he is talking about pitching, I just love it. He's such an interesting thinker, and he puts it in such relatable terms. He is not going to beat you down with numbers and metrics. He understands those, but he approaches it in a much more human way, I think. And for him, he was not talking about the releases, the angles, the movement, but just hunching over a little bit. He wants to get more athletic on the mound, so he said he hunched over. I always love it after Gausman starts. He says, I don't know if I was throwing 90 or 98 out there. I just kind of feel it out. And someone who pitches so naturally like that, I think is very refreshing at this point. Gausman was getting too much movement on his splitter, which is not a problem that most pitchers can even dream of, getting too much movement. But Gausman needs to fool hitters by making them think that the splitter is going to stay in the zone until it doesn't, and it drops off the table at the very end. What's been happening lately is it's moving too early, and the hitter can stand there and say, oh, that's a splitter. I will let it go by. I'll let it go below the zone. So what he's doing now, instead of standing up straight, he's hunching over a little bit, which naturally drops his arm angle. This is working for him. His fastball velocity was there. His fastball location was absolutely there. And the splitter worked for him. And all season, Blake, I compared it, I think, to kind of a light version of Jose Berrios' 2022, where the numbers weren't there. But if you just watched an inning, nothing looked terrible. Nothing's looked terrible about Kevin Gausman this year, even though he had a high 4 ERA coming into this. It's just been a little bit off. And we've seen teams be able to sit on that splitter and ignore it. When you take that away from Gausman, it's so tough. I think this is kind of the adjustment that gets him back. I really think he is on the verge of a great finish, a real hot streak here. I don't think Kevin Gausman has gone anywhere. I still think he is that ace. And it's just a little tinker like this, but I'm amazed he's able to do it. I can't give enough credit to Gausman for making that adjustment mid-season. A lot of pitchers cannot do that. This is the value and the benefit of being someone who is naturally athletic and not rigid and overthought in their mechanics. He can make that switch really quickly, and he nailed it. So I think this is going to stick.
It's such a fascinating thing to hear, like, and the way he like lays it out, it's like, oh, the splitter's moving too much. And you're like, and like you said, it's like there are 90% of pitchers who are like, their ears peak up and they're like, that's a thing. That's like a guy coming in and being like, oh, I have too much velocity today. Like my fastball is hitting 102 regularly. I don't like it. Now we know of guys who, when the fastball ticks up like that, they struggle to control it. This is kind of that. And some of it is the command and the consistency, but the way he describes it, where it carries the zone a little bit more. Basically, if the splitter's moving too much, the movement profile on it might give away that it's a splitter too early, because it's not, you don't want it dropping before it gets to the plate. You want it dropping through the plane of the plate. So it'll be interesting to see. And I think, you know, hopefully that lets the fastball play up a little bit. Like, you know, the fastball's always been a setup, the splitter pitch, but it's really gotten hit hard this year. So it'll be interesting to see how that one carries on. Keegan, it is July, and we won't talk to you next week because we don't have shows. So we're going to talk some trade slop in those final weeks of July. But you had an interesting note in your write-up of, I want to say, Saturday's game, the Yariel start. And it was about Chad Green, who has, danced around some trouble here, but pitched mostly well. The velocity is back up closer to where it was before the Tommy John surgery a year and a half ago. A guy who has pitched in big pressure moments and big pressure environments. We've all kind of talked about the trade deadline as if, well, the guys who are expiring, the guys who are about to be free agents. But Chad Green, as an experienced leverage reliever who, yes, is under contract for next year, but at 10 or 11 million, you know, maybe you're okay not having that on your books, even though he's a good and valuable guy. What do you make of the potential for a contender to come and say, hey, yeah, there's Jimmy Garcia, there's Trevor Richards, we'd like a crack at Chad Green too?
He almost sits in the middle for me, Blake, between the expiring guys and the guys with 1 year left, because he's a reliever, and given the nature of relievers and how often teams flip over their bullpens. And I've been so impressed by Chad Green, both on and off the field. You will not find a single person that has a bad word to say about this guy. No team would have a problem welcoming Chad Green. He has looked great on the mound this year. And that $10.5 million next year, I think this is an interesting spot, Blake, where the Blue Jays could chase some sort of legitimate prospect return. Yeah, with Yusei Kikuchi, you could get a bit. With Danny Jansen, you could get a bit. Justin Turner, you look at Kevin Kiermaier, I don't know where that would go. Jimmy Garcia could get you a bit. But we need to think 2026 and beyond. Who is the next core of this team? You don't want single-A guys who you're never going to see. You need players who will be legitimate pieces of this team, at least some top 30 guys. My goodness. Chad Green, I think, will have interest at the deadline, of course, given how he is pitching. This is also a scenario, Blake, and the Blue Jays have done this a lot in the past. I think they've done it well, where they use money in trades. So if they are shedding some salary with the Kiermaiers, with the Turners, on and on, they can use some money to pay down contracts like that to get back a better prospect. So how that works is, say, here's what our deal is. Well, what if we kicked in $5 million? Could we get a better guy? Could we get two prospects instead? Especially as teams around baseball might be going up against some spending limits of their own. So Chad Green, I think, would be an opportunity for the Blue Jays to explore something with more potential instead of just pivoting to next year. Yeah, I get it. There are players under control and there are jobs to save for next year. That's just as big a factor. But you need to have an eye on 26 and beyond, because if you don't early, then 26 and beyond looks real, real ugly, real scary. So I think the Blue Jays, this is a front office that I don't think has been caught in that situation often. They like to do business a year ahead of time. So they will not be eager or looking to, of course. But Chad Green would be a pretty attractive guy to a contender who thinks they're going to stay a contender.
And yeah, your point about the budget is a good one. I brought this up with, you know, I think we kicked around a hypothetical Jansen to Seattle deal where you take back, you know, long, like money owed for 2024. And yeah, it's a roster player, but it's mostly financially motivated. It's like, just because you're a seller doesn't mean you have to operate like the Rays or a small market team, right? You can use some of that financial might. You know, if you think back to the Francisco Liriano trade, where you then eventually turned him into Teoscar Hernandez, but the initial trade was, you know, a big part of that was taking the money on Francisco Liriano. It wasn't necessarily that the Pirates like really, really wanted Drew Hutchison and thought he was better than Francisco Liriano. You not only got Francisco Liriano, who you turned into Teoscar Hernandez, you picked up two other prospects in that trade. One of those guys was Reese McGuire. One was Harold Ramirez, who didn't work out here and isn't working out in Washington, but had a moment there. Like, you can use your financial flexibility, especially at a time when there are these questions about regional TV deals and, you know, those revenue streams and things like that. Last one for you quickly before I let you go here, Keegan. Ricky Tiedemann going to make the bump to AAA this week, stretch out to maybe 80 pitches or so. What are you looking for? How close to the radar do you think that is?
He can be a few starts away, especially if somebody like Yusei Kikuchi gets traded. The Blue Jays would have that door wide open. And as long as Tiedemann is up around 80, 90 pitches, and he is throwing something that resembles strikes, I mean, his stuff is ready. His stuff was ready 2 years ago. That's never been the conversation. It's all about workload and getting him into routines, which is another one of those vague words that means a lot of things. But just getting him into a health and arm care routine to take care of himself so he can do this over and over and over. A lot of guys can throw 100. Not a lot of guys can do it for 10 years. They want him to do it for 10 years. That's the gist of this right now. But Tiedemann being back right now, man, it's July 9. Timing's really good. If he can get 4 or 5 solid starts, he does not need to dominate and make people look like fools, but solid starts where he's controlling the game, pitching like a starter instead of pitching like a closer for 5 innings, he can come up for the end of the year. And that would be another sign of hope, I think, for a team that needs some of this towards the end of the season. But it is officially back in Tiedemann's hands right now. And given the trade deadline, he could have a door wide open. I didn't know if it would get to this point, but I think this lines up really well for him. He's got a big opportunity if he can stay healthy, which has been the if all along.
That's could be a lot of fun and on a short list of things to watch for after July 30th. Keegan, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Enjoy your day in San Fran.
You got it, buddy. We'll see you soon.
All right. Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of Blue Jays. Marin.com. Make sure you're subscribed to his newsletter and you're checking out all of his work over there. I know he's also been putting in work on that book that'll come out in 2025 that we're waiting on a pre-sale date for. Let's take a break. Let's check out someone else's work. At Baseball America tomorrow, well, first of all, Baseball America last week released an updated top 100 prospects ranking that included 8 Seattle Mariners and only 2 Blue Jays, Ricky Tiedemann and Aroldis Martinez, who had both dropped significantly down the list, in one case because of, PED suspension, and in the other case, because he hasn't been very healthy. Tomorrow, Baseball America will drop a new top 30 just for the Blue Jays system. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Jeff Ponce of Baseball America about just that as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays not in action last night. They'll get back in action in San Fran. The Buffalo Bisons are in action at 11 a.m. In spirit of that, let's talk some prospects. Jeff Ponce is our guy at Baseball America, leads the Blue Jays coverage and checking there. Last week, they released a new top 100 prospects list. Tomorrow, they will drop an updated list for the Blue Jays system specifically. Jeff, how you doing, man?
Pretty good, man. Things are going good. You know, got the updates out. Of course, I got one guy in Spencer Horowitz who could potentially graduate tonight with one at bat. So,
well, it's a lefty.
I might have to make some changes there.
It's a lefty on the mound, so maybe he doesn't. It's Blake Snell, so maybe he sits lefty versus lefty. Although he did have a 3-hit game against a lefty last week. Before we get to the Jay stuff, I did want to ask you, I wasn't going to be mean like this, but then I saw the Celtics jersey in your background, so I'm going to pick at it. There are 2,000 or some players in the NCAA transfer portal for baseball right now. Can you rank them for us, 1 through 2,000?
We have rankings up there, actually.
I know.
The top 50.
Yeah.
I think a couple guys I've seen this year, Daniel Dickinson is one who's from Utah Valley or something like that. I didn't even know they had a baseball team, and he's one of the top guys. I think he just committed to Tennessee. So it's crazy, man. It's like free agency. You know, we had the whole Texas A&M thing that went down, and just the amount of players that went into the portal from that team. Of course, their coaches obviously made the big jump to Texas like hours after they lost the national championship game.
Yeah.
Really unusual situation.
Hours after being like, how dare you ask me about that? And then doing it. Okay. So the transfer portal I'm joking about, but the draft is this weekend. I know you guys do a ton of draft coverage collectively. We're going to have Carlos on the show tomorrow to preview the draft a little bit. But from your perspective, like, you're more on the like pro side and doing the kind of farm system rankings and minor leagues and checking like that. What is your involvement in the draft? Or like, I guess more like, hey, someone's going to get drafted on the weekend, number 20 overall by the Blue Jays, and you're going to have to figure out where to slot them in the Jays top 30 or where to slot those guys in the top 100. So what is your process like this time or not just you, but Baseball America entirely, kind of blending the draft coverage with that pro minor league system coverage?
Yeah, so we have, a ranking and grading system that sort of transcends whether we're doing draft coverage or if we're doing pro coverage, and it all sort of dovetails pretty nicely. The grades are in line, the risk factors are in line, which sort of gives us our grade. It's that risk factor has a certain deduction against the overall, we'll say OFP or BA grade is what we call it, and that kind of gives us an order, which is why we'll have guys for like a 55 extreme who are behind a guy who's maybe like a 50 high. And a lot of that is sort of trying to balance, I would say, the delta between upside and ceiling and sort of what the floor is of a given prospect. You could say, sort of the cliche thing is to say, well, the floor on any of these prospects is they're not going to make it. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think there's enough talent here. We've got enough history. We know what's going to work. Maybe guys don't necessarily hit the ceilings that we think they're going to hit, but, Dylan Cruz, for example, was a guy that's maybe struggled a little bit. I still think he's a major leaguer, so some of those things. I think that we have a process that feeds really well into our pro coverage. Though I don't do the rankings directly, I'm involved in the conversations. I have a lot of contacts on the amateur side, simply from doing draft coverage before I came over to BA when I was doing it at my own site. I built up a lot of that. And I've been covering the Cape League for about 6 years now and have some history down there. So, you know, just the way the Cape is, you tend to meet a lot of cross-checkers, a lot of area scouts, a lot of decision makers and acquisition decision makers within draft rooms, and just build relationships with those guys. And, you know, throughout the process, try to work my contacts and feed information to Carlos that allows us to have the best rankings that we can have.
And again, we'll talk to Carlos on the show tomorrow and preview the draft a little bit, try to get him to nail down who the Jays are taking at number 20. You know, last year they took Arjun Namala at number 20, who's still, you know, pretty well regarded. He's actually on fire in Dunedin right now since taking a stint on the development list and a couple games in the Complex League. We'll maybe circle back to him in a bit. Just wanted to explain for anyone who doesn't know, when Jeff is talking about the BA grade or the future value grade, you know, that's on a 20 to 80 scale. And then there's also a risk factor of like, what is the likelihood a guy makes it? What is the likelihood a guy flames out? And there's, I've never seen anyone below medium risk. There's like medium, high, and extreme risk. So if someone is, you know, an 80 grade, an 80 BA grade with low risk, obviously they're the number one. There's no risk that they're not going to be the best guy, down to like, hey, maybe this guy's a 45, but he's an extreme risk. So there's potential he's a major league piece, but there's a lot of volatility there. So it's always cool to look at the top 30 that comes out for the Jays, say, tomorrow and see, oh, this guy, you know, Kendry Rojas, for example, has a higher upside than some of the guys ahead of him on the list, but the potential for Kendry Rojas to just not work out is much higher, so he slides down a little bit. Is that a fair way to explain the grade with the risk factor?
It's spot on. It's exactly what it is. You know, it's just sort of giving... So we put the grade out there in terms of what the overall, upside is, and then sort of use the risk against that to sort of deduct of like, all right, like this is where, you know, there might be some concerns or a risk, or it's just a riskier profile. And I think you tend to see that more with high school draft picks, particularly, you know, certain position groups within high school, power hitters within high school that maybe don't have up the middle profiles, high school catchers tend to carry extreme risk. Certainly high school pitchers by and large carry extreme risk. I mean, even the guys, the high school pitchers we see that come out and look great for half a season can then really falter, and we can see some injuries. I mean, we've sort of seen that with Ricky Tiedemann, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's been a tough one here. And Ricky Tiedemann, along with Aurelvis Martinez, sliding down the top 100 update that came out last week. Aurelvis from 51 to 74, Tiedemann from 33 to 76. That top 100, by the way, I forget who it was, but someone at Baseball America looked at all the All-Stars in Major League Baseball this year and ran the quick numbers on it. For anyone who wonders about the value of this top 100 list, 70% of the guys on All-Star teams this year were at one point on the BA top 100 list, and 80% of position players. So especially when it comes to position players, pitchers are obviously super volatile, especially when it comes to position players. You guys have historically done a pretty good job nailing the upside guys.
Yeah, and I think the thing with pitchers, and this is something that I think we're learning more and more about, is there's so many of these sort of college guys that build up innings in college. They're pitching in competitive games. It's just a different environment than what we see in the minor leagues, where, you know, even winning a midweek game, but certainly these weekend games, which are where these top pitching prospects are typically pitching, you know, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday starts, those are games that from February until the end of the season, you know, they want to win those games. There's a fan base behind it. Coaches' jobs are on the line, where, you know, you're looking at a double A team, a high A team. It's really about the development. How, you know, how is that coach allowing this environment to sort of flourish in terms of development? It's a different goal. I think that's great for position players. I think when it comes to pitchers, they sort of need to build up arm strength, build up the ability to work deep into games and just pitch, right? I think that's something that, you know, I'm a numbers guy. I break down all the data in terms of pitch movement and all that stuff. I love it. But at the same time, you've got to be able to marry that with somebody who knows how to efficiently get through a lineup three times. And there's just not a lot of guys that can do that. I think we see guys like, you know, Christian Scott from the Mets, who's a guy that, you know, sort of popped, that was a reliever in college. Brandon Sproat, who was a reliever most of his time in college, and I'm saying naming some Mets here. But even a guy like Quinn Matthews from the Cardinals, who was, you know, 89 to 92 through a ton of innings. I mean, I think he had a 153 pitch game in the regionals last year. Now he goes to pro ball. He's on a different schedule. his fastball now went from 89 to 92 to 94 to 97 with the same sort of movement. And I feel like that's sort of the thing with pitching. The other part with pitching too is I feel like so much development happens at the major league level. It's a matter of getting there, proving that you can start, they can trust you there. And then you start to work with major league pitching coaches, you start to face major league lineups, which there's no way to really replicate that in the minors or in college or whatever. That guys maybe take their lumps and then they learn. I mean, we even look at a guy like Clayton Kershaw, who's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. That's a guy that I think had a 5+ ERA in his rookie season. And then after that was one of the most dominant stretches we've seen. It just consistently happens.
Yeah, Christopher Sanchez, another more recent example of a guy who took some lumps before figuring it out. It's something I've talked to Chris Bassett about in the past as well. He was a college reliever. And then, I asked him about someone else, Bowden Francis, developing a new pitch. And he was like, he gave me an answer, but he was kind of like, yeah, the more important thing when you're 26, 27 and starting for the first time is you got to figure hitters out and what they're trying to do to you. Okay, so let's, by the way, with respect to the numbers and the data, if you are a Jays fan, under no circumstances look at the Robo Scout stuff. There are just no Jays anywhere on there. It's really upsetting.
And Dylan is in Toronto. He's a Toronto native and a huge Blue Jays fan. So believe me, if there was a way for us to factor that into the scores,
unbelievable.
We would push up those Blue Jays guys. But yeah, right now, not so much.
Okay, so the farm system's not in a great spot generally. This top 30 update that'll come out tomorrow, you gave me a sneak peek at it. I won't give too much away. But one of the fastest rising names you joked about earlier, if he gets one at bat tonight, he's technically no longer a prospect. And that's Spencer Horwitz, who, if he remains on the list, will have jumped from 20 to 8. Obviously, the hit tool has never really been in question. The question has been, is he going to hit for enough power? And then what does that look like as a first baseman? What has he shown you in this major league stint? And then how much does it help his projection or his ranking that he's shown he can, you know, not at an elite level, but capably handle second base a couple times a week?
Yeah, I mean, he looks great. I don't think we ever had any question if this guy could hit. It's similar to the way Davis Schneider was, where this was one of the tougher guys to rank because consistently I look at the underlying numbers. I look at the performance. I saw a lot of Horwitz in Buffalo and then the year before in New Hampshire. So I'm really familiar with the player. It was the same with Schneider. And, you know, even internal conversation, external conversations, I don't think they necessarily know how to value a guy like this because he doesn't. Perception was that he didn't have a lot of defensive value. I think we've seen that play out with Schneider. Horwitz has actually been an above average second baseman in his time this year. He already has, I think, like a 1.5, 1.25 WAR year already. And that's, you know, in 27 games. So the production's been excellent. He's been really solid at second base as well. I mean, I think if we go back a couple of years, this is kind of what we hoped Kevin Biggio would be. And we're seeing it with a lot better contact skills. I think better underlying power, though maybe the angles aren't as strong. But overall, I just think he's a better hitter. He's showing the fact that he can handle second base at least an average level in the major leagues. And even if it ticks down to like a fringe average level over the course of a full season, he's playing well there. And I think it's just a steadying influence. And somebody you can sort of look at and say, yeah, he's a little bit older at 26, but you know, we have control over this guy for a few years and, you know, should they hit the reset button, this is a guy that probably won't get moved and should be part of this lineup for the next 3-4 years.
Okay. So, that's great on the hitter side. The Jays need a win on the pitching side as well. And there are a few guys who have made their debut on the list or will make their debut on the list tomorrow. No one making a bigger jump than Ryan Jennings, who was not ranked in the internal top 30 before the season. And you're going to have him pretty high up in the system when those rankings drop tomorrow. He's a guy who just got promoted to double A from high A ball as well, a little older at 25, but how has Ryan Jennings, I mean, the 2.13 ERA at high A, that kind of speaks for itself over 50 plus innings. But what has Jennings been able to do to kind of not just get on the radar, but make a pretty big dent in that internal list?
Yeah, I think when we look at Jennings, it's a matter of fastball quality. The secondaries are fine. It's a really good fastball. There's velocity there. There's interesting release traits. He commands the ball really well, generates a lot of whiffs on that pitch. I don't know if he's a starter. I think when I talk to external sources, you know, scouts from opposing teams that cover the Jays organization, he was a guy that consistently got move up feedback. I think he was 31 or 32 on our offseason list because we do that like 31 to 40 after we released that top 30, you know, before the season starts. So he was kind of in the mix. I think I actually even wrote a report and then moved him off the list for somebody else. kind of regret that now because he's right in the middle of the system. He's going to move all the way up to 15, as you mentioned. But I think long term, he's probably a reliever, but could be a really good one. And I don't think that starting is necessarily out the window here either. It's another one of these guys that was a college pitcher. And sometimes it's a little bit slower to develop, but the stuff is there. He's showing the ability to consistently get deeper into lineups, get outs. You know, it doesn't have a huge track record of innings just simply because of injuries, et cetera. So building that up a little bit, you know, might be a question. I don't know how they'll necessarily handle him here in the second half of the season, but I think heading into next year, this is a guy that's kind of on the cusp of, you know, potentially being in the mix for the Blue Jays, whether it's his starts or in a long relief role or in a middle relief role. There's a lot of different things that he can do. And I think that for me, I value that versatility in pitchers because, as we talked about before, it sort of raises that floor of like, I can see this guy with a true major league role. It doesn't have to be as a starter, but that's not out the window either. So I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, he moves up over some of these just straight relief guys at the back of the list. They do have a lot of good relief arms, frankly.
Yeah, like TJ Brock, Hayden Yeager, Mason Flaherty, Connor Cook. I think all those guys are going to be somewhere in there. And I think they're, well, not all of them except for TJ Brock are at AAA right now. And probably like a trade deadline away from getting the call in some cases here. So a little further down the line, he was actually kind of the backfill for Ryan Jennings when Jennings went up to AA. And I'll ask you about him, not because he ranks all that high, but for the Canadian content here, the CanCon. Connor O'Halloran is going to break onto the list as well. Fifth round pick last year, already up as high as high A, and not an overage guy like Jennings. He's only 21. You know, it's been a little up and down since he joined Vancouver at high A there, but what are you hearing on O'Halloran-wise? How has he gotten kind of higher on your guys' radar?
Yeah, I mean, he was another guy that was on that 31 to 40, so it was just outside the list coming into the year. This with some graduates, et cetera, so we had to move some guys on. But I think the thing I like about O'Halloran, and I saw him in spring training in the complex there in Dunedin, you know, there's no, like, truly outstanding pitch, really. But he's got, you know, three different pitch shapes that he can go to consistently. You know, he can work against, you know, right-handed hitters or left-handed hitters and consistently get outs. He's not going to blow you away. It's more of a back-end starter, but I think you look at a lefty that has three different pitches that he can land for strikes. It's not all that common. And the thing that I really like about O'Halloran is the results against the fastball are much better than you would anticipate based on the velocity and the movement. I think some of that is left, you know, the left-handed sort of deception that you just get generally. But he's got a little bit of deception. He hides the ball really well in his operation. So it kind of comes on guys a little bit quicker than they would expect. So, you know, 91 from O'Halloran maybe plays a little bit more like 92 to 93 miles per hour. He can mix in his breaking ball. He's got a pretty good changeup as a left-hander as well. Can consistently get outs. And I think it's a good arm. I mean, is he a guy that I would look at as like, hey, this could be a number three, number four? No. I think it's more like a number five, emergency number six type of starter. But you know, you probably need eight or nine guys that, you know, can start for you in a given season when you go into the year in April. So I think this is the guy that in a couple of years could be in the mix there.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have eight or nine guys that could start for you for a change. That hasn't been the case the last couple of years. A guy who's not going to start for them was a starting pitching prospect back in the day and is now, you know, kind of the prodigal son of the prospect system. He's going to be back on the top 30 here. Eric Pardino was the number six prospect in the system in 2018, number four in 2019, and then number 15 in 2020, number 15 in 2021, number 25 in 2022, off the list entirely last year and coming into this year. We've talked about it a bunch on the show, but Pardino, unbelievable stretch of season at AA, struggled a little bit since getting the bump to AAA here, but he is back on the radar for you guys as a relief pitching prospect.
Yeah, I mean, he's just outside the top 20. I think he's at 22 is what the ranking is. But the thing with me with Pardino is I saw him come in New Hampshire. It was, you know, like one of those things where you hear the name and it was like, oh, that brings me back, you know, and my dad is actually Brazilian. So cool. I've always followed him, just, you know, being one of the rare Brazilian prospects, him and like Yan Gomes. So, you know, there was some excitement there to see what it would look like. And he came out throwing absolute fire. First pitch was 97 miles an hour with ride, got a swing and strike. He sat 94 to 97 throughout that outing. Came out for his second inning. He gets whiffs on the slider. He gets whiffs on the changeup. It's actually a really good changeup. There's three pitches there. I don't think he's going to be a starter, but this is sort of your power reliever that can go, you know, 4 to 6 outs pretty consistently. And I think the stuff is there as long as he's consistently throwing strikes. He's come back in a big way. The stuff is legit. I would say just in combination of movement, power, and strikes, he might even be the best reliever that I've seen over the last couple of years. I like Connor Cook more because the stuff is just so elite. I could see, you know, Cook turning into a Craig Kimbrel sort of reliever. It's just the stuff is that loud. You know, Pardino isn't that far off. You know, I think he's a guy that's maybe past Hagen Gannon and some of these others in terms of who I project to be part of their bullpen long term. But when you look at this list, I think that they have 5 or 6 really good bullpen pieces. And I'll say this is one thing about this Jays system. It's not exciting. You know, it's going to rank in the bottom, you know, third of our top 30s or farm systems, you know, throughout the game. But they have a lot of major league depth. There's a lot of guys in that 45 range throughout the system that I think could be major league players long term. They just don't have a lot of star power at the top, which is what really we take a lot of weight on in a ranking. So you look at a team like the Red Sox, who do have a lot of depth. They're really boosted by the top of their system with Teal and Anthony and Meyer and now Campbell or even Perales before the injury. So I think when you have like those top 100 caliber players, they're moving up. The other thing that's hurt the Jays a little bit too is Tiedemann's been hurt. I think, you know, in terms of the stuff, in terms of the feedback prior to the injury, Tiedemann was a guy that was easy top 25. He was one of my favorite pitching prospects in baseball. I would argue he's probably my favorite prospect in baseball. I've seen Ricky pitch probably 12 times now over the last couple of years. And then you have Orelvis Martinez, where it was a great story. It looked at the last 2 years, he had really, you know, come into his own. He had fixed the issues that he had with his swing decisions and some of that stuff. It allowed him to get to that power more consistently. And obviously those numbers were excellent, but the PED suspension obviously, you know, pushes him down a little bit. So that was a bit of a concern. But yeah, I think overall there's still some stuff to like here. There's some backfill pieces, but they don't have trade pieces to reinforce the team. They need some higher end players. You know, this draft and this trade deadline could potentially be really big for them and how this system plays out over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, it's tough. It's, you know, especially in a year where the bullpen's been so bad. And I know you don't want to add guys to the 40 too early. You don't want to push them too fast or whatever. But they're like, hey, yeah, one of the strengths of the system is you have a bunch of guys who could be solid relievers at a time when you have the 29th bullpen ERA in all of baseball is probably especially tough for fans to hear. Name for you, I'm sure you've heard the name, but because of the Brazilian connection, 18-year-old down in the Dominican part of the Jays system, San Omosako. I believe he came from the same academy as Eric Pardino, mm-hmm. and he has a 0.36 ERA right now in the very small sample, but in the Dominican League. So maybe another Brazilian for you to follow. Yeah, real quick before I let you go, he's been hot at AAA. I don't think people know a lot about him. Is Riley Tirada on the radar as like a maybe like future bench piece kind of bat?
This is the kind of guy that the Jays just crush it with. I mean, you look at Spencer Horowitz, later round pick, not a lot of pedigree. You look at Davis Schneider, later round pick, not a lot of pedigree. I know it didn't work out in the same fashion, but they got Vinny Capra a couple years ago to the major leagues, another guy, later round pick, not a lot of pedigree. I think it's the same with Tirada. What we've seen this year is a lot of the underlying traits that he was showing in 2023, he's still showing. Like, the contact, you know, isn't great, but it's good enough. They're really good swing decisions. He hits the ball really hard. It's really good angles on contact. So he's a guy when we look at expected WOBA on contact. So it's really just looking at the quality of the contact that somebody is making. You know, he ranks in the top, you know, 5th percentile in all of the minor leagues. And, you know, that's a guy that I think is just probably going to get up to the major leagues at some point this year, probably going to get a look. He's really hit in AA. He's really hit in AAA as well. And I think when we see guys put up production like this in AAA year after year, even without pedigree, those guys typically end up in the major leagues and they end up having good careers. You know, I can go back a couple of years to a guy like Mike Tauchman, who kind of bounced around a little bit, put up really good years in AAA, and then eventually got his shot. And we saw he was hitting leadoff for the Cubs prior to his injury. And I think there's a lot of guys like this that get a little bit underrated because they don't have the pedigree. They weren't on prospect lists. And then they go up to AAA and they prove at the minor league's highest level that they can hit. And I think that's what we're seeing with Toronto.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And also in typical Jays fashion, he plays almost every position on the diamond. So there's a path to opportunity there. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. And yeah, looking forward to that updated top 30 tomorrow. I won't spoil any more for the audience.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Jeff Bontz of Baseball America. Make sure you check that out. Again, we'll have Carlos on the show tomorrow to set up the draft and preview the draft a little bit. The Jays pick 20th on Saturday. We'll get a lay of the top of the draft as well. And yeah, Jeff and the rest of the team at Baseball America will have the updated Jays top 30 system list up tomorrow, which I got my hands on. And yeah, I guess the other name I should mention, and I said it to Jeff there, but we didn't go deep on it, is just Arjun Namala. To give you to level set for where the number 20 prospect from last year's draft is, he ranks fourth in the Blue Jays system right now. They had him third prior. Addison Barger jumped him because of the hot year at AAA, although things haven't gone super well for Barger at the major league level, and he's back with the Bisons now. But yeah, Arjun Namala, a 55 grade. So that's the second highest in the system behind only Ricky Tiedemann. There's just extreme risk because he's so young and has so far to go. But he, I mentioned him because we've talked about it a little bit. He started the year with that really aggressive placement in Dunedin, went to the developmental list, played a couple complex league games. He has been red hot since rejoining Dunedin. So seems to be figuring some stuff out there. And he would be younger than most high school players in this year's draft. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Craig Goldstein. We'll get the lay of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And yeah, I don't know. It's quieted down a little bit, but Jim Bowden was on with us last week and was pushing, hey, Bo Bichette would be a potential fit for the Dodgers. Let's see how Kevin Biggio is doing there. Let's see how Shohei Ohtani and Teoscar Hernandez are doing there. Let's see if Bo Bichette might be a fit there. A little early for that. And again, I don't think it's all that realistic that happens from a trade front, but let's see what's going on with the Dodgers when we return on Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little K-Flay for you. Lots of San Francisco lyrics throughout the week. There's a lot of music about San Francisco, a lot of bands from San Francisco. Let's go a little elsewhere in California. Let's talk about the Dodgers for a little bit here before we tee up Jays and Giants. Let's bring on our pal, Craig Goldstein of Baseball Prospectus. Craig, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad I didn't wear the same shirt. I have my BP shirt as well from, the one you sent me when I wrote in the annual. Still grief with you, by the way, for letting Steve Slatkowski from PUP write the essay for the Blue Jays this year. I just never hear the end of it. So thanks for that.
I don't know if you want to pass it along to him or if he's listening, but it's well beloved, too. People really liked it. So I don't know if that's going to go well for you.
I will not pass that along to him. His head is large enough as it is. Okay, so Craig, for those who don't know, you are the editor at Baseball Prospectus, and that comes with a lot of cool stuff, including you get to cover baseball and talk about baseball for a job and edit the annual and things like that. How big a benefit of the job is it that, like, obviously you get to talk with and manage and edit these very smart people where, like, I imagine your viewing schedule every night is like, okay, there's the Dodgers, and then, oh, someone wrote something cool about this guy. I'm gonna check that out. How big a plus for that is you? How big a part of the gig is that?
It's a huge part of it, because honestly, you know, as much time as I have to dedicate to the game right now, just being able to read these people, as you mentioned, and get smarter and key in on specific things. One of the guys I always talk to or make sure to read, and I think has been doing such a great job recently, won a Saber Award last year. Actually, a bunch of writers did. That was really, really a great advertisement for the site. But Robert Orr,
yeah,
who I know you've talked to before, just everything he writes, like, you start see, it's one of those like glass shattering moments, right? Where it's like, you didn't notice it before. And then all of a sudden it's the only thing you can see. Last week he wrote about Francisco Lindor and what he did when he moved to the first spot in the Mets lineup and how that's unlocked things for him and what it did in terms of his swing decisions, his approach at the plate and how that's unlocked things for him. And he comes up with something like that every week. I don't know how he does it. And again, like, it's not just him. We've got Russell Carlton, who's worked for two different teams and is a clinical psychologist and is great with statistics, right? He kind of covers every single aspect. Patrick Dubuque, I know you had on recently as well. As much as I've always been a Dodgers fan, like, I've never been able to be someone who only focuses and talks about one team, because you have to be able to put it in context. And so having the ability to look the league as a whole has always been huge for me.
And it's also, I mean, all those people are great. They're on our show regularly. Ginny, a bunch of other people. This is how we book the show. It's just like, we just fire up baseball perspectives, see who wrote something cool today. The other thing I'd imagine is, like, the Dodgers have entered this weird kind of space where, like, they're obviously interesting because they're very good, but, like, they're always very good. And they're so good that, like, watching Shohei remains incredible every day, watching Freddie Freeman, Mookie Betts, even Teoscar. But, like, we know where the Dodgers are going to be at the end of September. They're what? They're already 19 games above 500. One of the best run differentials, 7.5 game lead in the division. What is that part like? Like, this is going to be year 12 of the Dodgers, like, cleanly making the playoffs and having this now, like, okay, well, not it doesn't matter, but, like, talk to me in the playoffs, talk to me in the playoffs. What has that been like for you as a Dodgers fan?
It's a mental reset, really, because they don't care about the regular season, which, you know, you're saying, like, it doesn't matter. Maybe it's not quite like it doesn't matter, but it's a lot like that, because, you know, you just don't sweat every series. And even when I knew they'd be good, even when I knew they'd win, you know, 95 plus games, maybe 100 plus games prior to last year, you know, in the seasons prior to 2023, you still sweat. You were still sweating every series. I cared about every game. When they blew a game, it was upsetting. Things like that. There is a mental change of, like, you're trying to let it go because they just don't care that much. Then you see it with the lineups they put out. You see it with the relief choices they make sometimes. And it's just because they're trying to get through the season, right? There's obviously much of the league now makes long-term decisions on when to pull their pitchers and you know, are willing to sacrifice the chance, you know, the optimal chance at a game to further their overall season. But the Dodgers aren't doing it their overall season. It's really just the playoffs. It's just the postseason that they care about. And so that's something I'm not used to. I was a big regular season fan. I care about the regular season. So it's different for me. It's a very different experience. I suppose it's a little bit more relaxing, you know, taking 162 game season as a diehard fan can be tough, right? That's a long period to be intense. But it's going to make October that much harder. And October has that much, you know, has that much more random chance to it, has that much more variance in it. And so it's hard to pin everything on that, but that's what they're doing. They've spoken to it when they signed Shohei. They said they considered the last decade a failure. That includes a World Series. I know it's 2020, but it includes a World Series and making the playoffs every single year. They said that's a failure. So from their point of view, the regular season is inconsequential, and so I'm trying to adapt to that.
And it's interesting because while it means that some of the, you know, you don't sweat losing two series in a row, for example, you do probably, like, hyper sweat little details like, hey, Max Muncy's been shut down again. Can you head into August with the, well, if Max Muncy comes back? Or are you trying the Kevin Biggio thing again? How has the Kevin Biggio, by the way, has not started a game since June 29th. He has been Freddie Freeman's, like, this is a blowout, go play first base for an inning guy since then. How is the Kevin Biggio experience?
I think you just described it. Honestly, the thing that kind of surprised me the most, as much as we talked about, I try and check in on every team. I've never been the biggest Biggio believer at the plate, but I thought he was fine at third. It has not gone. Maybe he is in general, but he hasn't been as a Dodger. Yeah, it's a lot of he's booted a lot of balls, and it's just like if you're going to be as passive as he is at the plate, and you know, kind of where the upside is within range of league average. I'm not even going to say like league average or better. You have to be able to play defensively. And if you're not getting that, I mean, somehow Chris Taylor is like digging himself out of a shallow grave, or maybe not that shallow grave. So at this point, that's why you're starting to see that he's not playing as much. So yeah, I mean, I think something with the situation with Muncy is one that can be applied across a lot of roster spots. You know, Clayton Kershaw's rehab was shut down. It looks like he's going back to on a rehab assignment shortly. So it was a short one, but you never know. And the question is, what are they going to do about it? Because the only moves that matter for them are ones that make a difference come October. So you're talking about impact level talent. You're talking about maybe Garrett Crochet, someone like that. Whereas upgrading the margins, you know, if Miguel Rojas is going to be 15% better than league average with the bat, it's going to be hard to upgrade on the margins over him, which I never thought I would really be saying, but that's where things are right now. So I think it's tough. You know, they've had a lot of, I was just reading Joe Sheehan's recent newsletter, which was a NL West kind of spin around. And he talked about all the dead spots in their lineup. And there are a ton. There's Gavin Lux. There's, you know, Biggio has received some of those. It's Chris Taylor. It's Enrique Hernandez. But these guys should not, Austin Barnes should probably not be taking any postseason at bats, but they have Miguel Vargas. You know, he's shown well in a short sample right now. Maybe James Outman fixed something in AAA. We'll see. I don't know that you're necessarily finding the guy, you know, bench pieces that are significant upgrades over those internal options. So it leaves them in a little bit of a weird spot come the trade deadline. They have to decide whether these guys are going to be healthy or not. The stars, the Muncies, the Kershaws, guys like that, whether Yoshinobu Yamamoto comes back healthy, or whether they need to go get the impact pieces that are potentially available.
Yeah. And it's a hard one to figure because they have 14 guys on the IL right now. Like it's ridiculous. Like the Jays fans sometimes say, oh, it's been a tough run. You know, Romano and Garcia on the IL at the same time, Manoah, 14 guys, 6 starters, 5 relievers, and then Muncy, Betts, and Hayward, like every day, I guess Hayward platoon, but the strong side of a platoon, like guys who are in there every day and they're still very, very good. So it's gotta be a tough spot because you would obviously hate to get to the playoffs and like Kershaw just hasn't gotten back to being Kershaw. Walker Buehler, you know, I don't know, say has a setback in August or something like that. Like you'd hate to not address those things. So it's also like Gavin Stone and Landon Knack have filled in pretty good in the rotation. They're running a 6-man rotation right now. So it's a fascinating one. Let me throw a hypothetical by you because look, everything we've got, the sense that we've gotten here in Toronto from talking to our insiders around the Jays and things like that, is that if the Jays sell, which they obviously should, it'll be, yeah, the free agents and maybe, you know, who maybe a Chad Green type who has a 2025 contract or whatever. But this team is going to intend to compete again next year. And that would mean Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette and guys like that are back. However, we've had, you know, Jim Bowden on the show and he said, yeah, the Dodgers and Yankees have called on Bo Bichette or would have interest. That's the chatter around the league or whatever. When it comes to a name like Bo Bichette, who is having a down year, but has a really, like he's never hit lower than 290 or OPS below 800 before. This is a real outlier season. In fact, based on the Baseball Prospectus Pecota projections, this is below the 1 percentile outcome for Bo Bichette. So he's going to be better. Does someone like that, who not only is better than Rojas, Lux, and Taylor, and Biggio, we know that, but also has an additional year, could you see the Dodgers going that route, or will it be more of a, you know, feel out where the holes are and just paper around?
No, I think if they're going to make a move, they're going to have to do something more like, I mentioned Garrett Crochet twice, but I think Bo fits into that mold very well. Obviously, the season has not gone as he or the Blue Jays have planned. I was talking about this just yesterday on my podcast with Jeffrey Paternostro, and we talked about how he did have a season a little bit like this, not quite this bad, where a absolutely scorching hot September saved kind of the season line. He was just one of the most absurd months I've ever seen. I think it was two seasons ago, going off the top of my head. But so he does have some of these down periods, these streakiness, right? This is someone who puts the ball in play as much as he does is going to experience that sometimes. But yeah, I think he is a good fit for their roster. You know, again, Mookie Betts was their starting shortstop. They're willing to sacrifice defense for an overall extremely high quality player. And Mookie's transition has been utterly incredible, to take nothing away from him, but he's not the most elite defender out there. Bichette isn't either, but the whole package is obviously worthwhile. And you move Mookie to second base, which means you move Lux to the bench, which means you move maybe Kevin Biggio off the roster. Maybe it's Enrique Hernandez off the roster, you know, someone like that. So you actually end up strengthening your bench, assuming you think Gavin Lux is an improvement in that situation. Maybe he goes in a trade. I mean, that's the other part of it. Who knows? And I do think they actually match up well from a system standpoint to what Toronto might ask, which I expect to be quite a lot. Because the Dodgers do have more depth than they do impact at the top, but that depth is pretty high quality. And so it really depends on what a team might be looking for. When I've mentioned the White Sox before in terms of Crochet or even a Luis Robert for the Dodgers, I don't think there's as good of a matchup there, if only because some of the most tradable options for the Dodgers are catchers. And while the White Sox shouldn't consider their team, you know, shouldn't consider Corey Lee in the way of anyone. They did trade for Corey Lee just last year. They traded for Edgar Cuero just last year. It just might not be the well they want to go to again if they're being choosy. And with those two guys, I think they have the luxury to be choosy, right? I think for the Jays, you're talking about if they're selling, Danny Jansen's probably on the block, right? Mm-hmm. Alejandro Kirk's had a rough year. It would make sense if they were interested in a Dalton Rushing or a Teron Lorenzo. Diego Cartaya is a little bit of a weird guy. I don't think, not a weird guy, a weird profile right now. I don't know that he'd headline any sort of deal, but you could see the Dodgers have a lot of depth there. They just debuted Justin Robleski, as you mentioned, a six-man rotation. He debuted on Sunday. He's, you know, 93 to 97, pounds the zone. He's an interesting arm. They have arms for days, right? I think these are things that the Blue Jays might be interested in. Again, they could craft a package of three or four guys potentially for someone like Bichette of quality depth. They might not all be, you know, you might not get a top 15 prospect in baseball, but you could get four top, you know, 100, 150, you know, and who everyone's opinion on the guys in those range can be you know, varied. But I think that's a deal that could make sense. And again, help the Dodgers defensively, you know, move Mookie to second, like I said, strengthen their lineup. And he gives them a ton of contact in a lineup that can be swing and miss prone at times. Again, a balance to someone like Max Muncy, you know, who if healthy, obviously takes a lot of pitches, has a lot of strikeouts. Someone who puts the ball in play. Again, a balance to someone like Teoscar Hernandez, who you guys are very familiar with, who has a ton of damage on contact, but will swing and miss, will expand the zone, things like that. So, yeah, long story short, I absolutely think it's a match, and I think that's the type of acquisition, if they're going for, that makes the most sense for them.
And that's, I'm sure it's exciting for some Blue Jays fans to hear that, you know, that's kind of what you could be looking at there. Now, let's re-level set for the fact that, you know, at least around here, it hasn't seemed like that's something the Jays are necessarily going to explore unless they get blown away. Right. That is attractive. Now, the rental markets, and I know you guys, but you specifically do a lot of transaction analysis over the years. You see the Aaron Civale return, which probably sets the market. And that's a very low bar to set the market at early. But what should Jays fans expect if they do sell a Danny Jansen, Yusei Kikuchi, Jimmy Garcia, more of that rental market type? Jays fans obviously are familiar with being buyers in that regard the last couple of years. You know, a Sem Roberta and Adam Klopfenstein, a two double-A starters last year for Jordan Hicks, for example. Right. You know, a kind of nothing prospect for Paul DeJong, who is now a terrific home run hitter after the Blue Jays let him go. On the seller side, you know, what does that market generally look like for really good pieces like Kikuchi, Garcia, Jansen, but not, you know, not a certain top three in your playoff rotation guy, not a certain you're going to close games guy, probably a guy who's going to split time at catcher. What do those returns generally look like?
I think it's going to be better than the Aaron Civale deal, honestly.
Hope so.
I think I think that one was Tampa really wanted to make room for Shane Baz. And as much as starting pitching is needed kind of everywhere, there was a really good fit in Milwaukee who have kind of been the walking wounded in terms of their rotation. And I say that as though they signed Jake Junis to be in the rotation and he's in their bullpen and they're pushing Bryce Wilson back to their bullpen. So they're getting a little bit healthier. But I say that. And at the same time, Dallas Keuchel's in their starting rotation. So it's all kind of relative, you know? And so I think Savala, as I wrote in a recent TV, is the biggest thing for him is that just he can get out there and throw some innings. He's not an elite innings eater in any respect, but for Milwaukee, that means more. They have a great defense. Tampa's defense, obviously generally a well-regarded unit in that respect. Very middle of the pack this year, and Milwaukee is number two in our defensive ratings. And if you take out catcher framing, they're actually number one. So they can really go get it. And I think throwing someone like Saval in front of them just is going to look better than make him look better than he even is. All that to say is that I just don't think he's setting the market. I agree. It's the first one in July. It's going to be referenced as a point. But when it comes to someone like Kikuchi, who I think is just a better pure pitcher, and teams don't have to worry about how good their defense is specifically in front of him, right? I think that was a big factor in Milwaukee's, both the price and Milwaukee's willingness to take him on, right? The money, take on the extra year, is that they know that they can accommodate him. I think someone like Kikuchi, Jimmy Garcia, I know he's very close to getting healthy here, has been one of the elite relievers in baseball this year. These are guys you don't have to worry about how good your defense is behind them. They can just go out and give you quality innings. And so I think those guys certainly make the most sense. Jansen is going to be a tough one. And I shudder to say that because he shouldn't be. He's been so, so good, right? When healthy, he's been one of the top hitting catchers in baseball over the last several years. But midseason catcher trades are always weird. You can go back and look. Obviously, it's not the same offensive profile, but Christian Vasquez, when he went to Houston from Boston, it's just teams don't like to make that disruptive move to their rotations midseason, and you have to get to go know a new guy, have that guy have to know a new staff entirely. It's just a very complicated situation. So I don't know where to go with Danny Jansen, what that market will be. As a bat, especially a team that might want to play him at DH occasionally, maybe you find a situation there. But even in the trade I referenced, the Boston Red Sox went and got Willier Abreu in that Vasquez trade. So you can still find something there, but they're always a little bit weirder than you think when you're talking about trading a backstop midseason.
It's a tough one. Craig, quickly before I let you go here, because you're a Dodgers guy, you see a lot of that Giants team as well that the Jays are about to see. You guys have them for 11% playoff odds from here, given the hole they've dug themselves in. They get Blake Snell back tonight. And if Blake Snell's back to Blake Snell, the top three in that rotation looks really good. But is that enough? Should the Giants, I mean, not even sell, they might be too far leveraged, but are they just going to kind of stay in the middle here?
I mean, look, given their history, it's hard for me to say anything but stay in the middle. They also did just get Kyle Harrison back. Yeah. So their rotation, at one point I looked last week, they had two guys in it. So that's always a tough look on the depth chart. But I think, look, they can absolutely make a push with the talent that they have. But I think, look, again, if you're looking at a stealthy team that might want to make a big acquisition for someone like a Bo Bichette, maybe you're looking at the Giants because they're running Nick Ahmed out there every day at shortstop. And that's, again, that's the face I would make too. And so, again, you're looking for a little more offense. They're very committed. They've wanted the big name. They finally got, Jung-Woon Hoo, and then he got, hurt for the rest of the year. Again, I don't know how much they want to push payroll, how much their capacity they have to push payroll, but if they do, that might be something they're willing to do. And they have enough members of their roster, 40-man roster at or near the major league level that, they have some interesting pieces that could potentially go back the other way.
Yeah, it could be fun to see. We'll see Blake Snell tonight. We'll get a good look at this Giants team. Craig Goldstein, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man.
Thanks for having me, Blake.
Greg Goldstein of Baseball Prospectus. Make sure you're checking out all their great work. In addition to, you know, the other side, we're doing the big three today. We had a Baseball America, we had a Baseball Prospectus. We're going to do Fangraphs next. But yeah, make sure you're checking out all the great work there. They have playoff odds there as well. Again, the Giants sitting at 11%. Fangraphs has them a little bit higher, just a little bit more deference to the quality. I think the big difference here is Fangraphs regresses a little bit more to like the talent level, whereas Pecota, the Baseball Prospectus one, is a little more, I don't know, maybe pragmatic about what a team has done so far. Like the Jays, although the Jays have 7% at Baseball Prospectus and only 3% at Fangraphs. So who knows? They're just differences in the models. But either way, the Jays have very little chance. And the Giants need a series win here to avoid also having very little chance. They got to start making up some ground here and make some decisions before the deadline. Let's take a break. Let's go to Fangraphs. Let's talk to Davey Andrews as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays in action tonight in San Francisco, 9:45. Yusei Kikuchi against Blake Snell. Rest of the series is Chris Bassett against Logan Webb and Kevin Gausman against Jordan Hicks. Splitter versus splitter. That'd be a fun one to check out. That one is Thursday afternoon at 3:45. So make sure you are ducking out of work early. There's going to be a lot of that with the Olympics coming up. There's going to be a lot of me having basketball games up on my computer while I talk about baseball as well. I shouldn't say that on air, but whatever. Let's go to our next guest, Davey Andrews of Fangraphs, to bail me out of this tailspin here. Davey, how we doing, man?
Blake, I'm really disappointed in you. You know, you got to pay attention to work. What are you doing here?
Yeah, unbelievable. Look, man, I'm going to pivot this to put you on, not even put you on blast. I would like to discuss your wife putting you on blast. So for anyone who doesn't remember, Edouard Julien, Canadian player for the Minnesota Twins, was red hot. Davey writes a song about it, and Edouard Julien completely falls off a cliff. So now Jose Miranda is red hot, and your wife is concerned you are going to jinx Jose Miranda now as well?
I mean, my wife doesn't follow baseball. So Edouard Julien, she plays a game where she'll be like, let's see how many players I can name. And she usually tops out around 11. And she'll go, who's the guy from the home run derby? And I'll be like, the polar bear? And she'll go, Alonzo. And that's about it. But so I told her, you know, there's a guy on the Twins. He's got 10 straight hits. And she just turns to me. She goes, so are you going to tank him too?
Pretty good stuff there. Jose Miranda hitting .332. Good for him. And good job from your wife there. Let's talk about the Twins for a minute. They needed 11 innings to beat the White Sox last night, but where is the confidence level right now? Because I know you do a lot of Twins stuff as well, and not just about their eye black. Carlos Correa and Byron Buxton kind of look like Carlos Correa and Byron Buxton right now. So as much as the Twins have some holes and some stuff you can pick at, I'd imagine those two guys looking like themselves goes a long way for your confidence in that AL Central.
Absolutely. And I think you're also seeing there's so many, you know, Royce Lewis, when he's healthy, is just on another planet. And Miranda can put that stretch together. You know, there are a lot of players on this lineup where you could see them making a run. If it's all clicking, they have a very scary lineup. There are some holes, you know, first base hasn't been great, and the corner outfield spots have left a little bit to be desired sometimes. But you can see where if everyone's healthy, all of a sudden, and, you know, they get Edouard Julien back, and all of a sudden Miranda is an amazing first baseman with the bat, then all of a sudden this lineup has very few holes. And so, you know, they need some things to go right, but it could be a very dangerous team, you know, a team that you don't want to face.
Yeah, I certainly didn't want to face them for two games last year, really, really briefly either. Look, because it's July, kind of any time a team comes up, we take a look at, you know, what is the deadline priority going to be for them. Now, this is a Twins team that I think we believe is operating with some budget constraints given the uncertainty, right, you know, and things like that. But if they you know, if they were to address, and they have an average-ish farm system that they can pull from, kind of a weird farm system where guys always end up outperforming their you know, ranking and expectations and things like that. But if this team was going to address an area between now and the end of July, where do you think they would focus that?
Well, I mean, it's a little tricky. Like I said, the lineup has a lot. You know, Brooks Lee just came up and is hitting right away. There aren't that many holes in the lineup. And, you know, I think many people, someone just wrote an article at Twins Daily today about addressing holes in the starting pitching. And it's a little tricky. I think that's where you'd have to look. But it's not as if their starting pitching has been bad. You know, they seem to have had some bad luck. They've allowed a lot of fly balls, and so it's easy for a few more fly balls to turn into home runs, and then all of a sudden you look much worse than you are. You know, by ERA, I think they have the 23rd worst ERA in baseball, but by expected FIP, they're the, I think it's the eighth best. So the fifth best, sorry, I'm confusing my notes. But so they have a lot of It's hard to see any one place where they are dying for help. It's just they need a few things to go right.
And that headline at Twins Daily was not just which starting pitching should the Twins target. Yes. It was which Blue Jays starting pitcher should they target. So that wasn't your piece. We won't hold you accountable for it. But what did you think of that idea generally? Obviously, the Jays have Yusei Kikuchi, who is a free agent after this season and only makes $10 million. That's a guy, flexibility-wise, that probably every contending team in baseball could fit in. But your colleague there, Ted, also threw out the Gausman, the Bassett, the Barrios possibilities as well. Guys with a little bit more term and certainly some money there. But guys, at least in the case of Bassett and Barrios, who are having pretty good years.
Right. And I mean, I think you would love to have those guys. However, when you look at the numbers, and as you said, coming into this season, the poll ads made it clear that even though they did pretty well in the playoffs last year, they were looking to cut payroll and have done so. It's hard for me to see them adding, you know, Gausman is making $22 million a year for the next two seasons. And the Twins are also locked in some places. You know, Pablo Lopez just signed an extension through 2027, and Joe Ryan and Bailey Ober are about to hit arbitration. So I think Kikuchi makes a lot more sense because he's shorter term and he's left-handed. But there's no one slam dunk candidate. You know, there's no one player on the Twins that you'd say, we need to get this guy out and get somebody in his place. And I think when you look at the numbers, the Blue Jays and the Twins, their starters have a lot of similarities. So it's hard to say, oh, this is definitely the guy. Kikuchi makes a lot more sense from a contract standpoint, but you also never know how a guy's second half is going to go.
Yeah, that's true. And then, I mean, I guess the other question would be, you know, where is the fit from a prospect standpoint or whatever. This Twin system, you'd know it a little better than I would. It, you know, most of the places have it ranked around kind of average. And again, some of their guys, there is a consistency there of guys come up and they end up overperforming what the, you know, the prospect rankings or whatever thought. But where is the strength of that system or the depth of that system if they were going to trade from it?
Right. Well, I mean, it's a little tricky because, and organizationally, a lot of it is up high. You know, they have a couple guys who are really close. And so in that respect, you know, like I said, Brooks Lee just came up. So in that respect, you sort of think maybe because we have guys who are close and are now major leaguers, they're a little untouchable. Maybe you would be willing to part with a little more than average. But you also have to remember the way this team operates, which is that they don't give out huge contracts. And so those prospects are really important to them. And when you're a team, who, as you said, your prospects have overperformed, you tend to think, or you want to think, that that's because your player development and your scouting is doing a good job. And so you should value those guys a little higher than other teams might, you know, because you trust your system.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And then, you know, if you're another team and you're picking them out, or, hey, are we as good a finishing school as the Twins are to get those guys, you know, to
exactly.
or your pro level player development. They're tough questions. So, by the way, your Twins beat the White Sox last night. They needed extra innings to do it. But, man, that White Sox team is now almost, and we have to do modern record because, like, there are teams from the 1800s that won, like, two games against a team of farmers or whatever.
And I would love to see them play the White Sox.
Yeah. Yeah, see who wins that. But I believe the White Sox are now on pace for 45 wins, which is pretty close to Detroit's kind of modern expansion era record of 43 wins. You've watched a lot of AL Central baseball over the years where there have been a lot of bad teams. Where does this White Sox team rank in terms of bad teams you've watched?
You know, I spent last season, so I've done some research for the MLB Network, and as the new guy, I think I sort of got the lesser games a lot of times. You know, they didn't, you know, I'm starting out, so they weren't going to have me do showcase games every week. And so I watched a lot of Tigers and White Sox and A's and Nationals last year. And I, in some ways, it feels like this is just an extenuation. The amazing thing about the White Sox is that they've had something like 40% of their starts from Fetty and Crochet, who are excellent pitchers and are doing amazing. It's almost more impressive considering that they have this one area where they're so good. You know, the rest of the team is compensating in a very sad way.
It's pretty remarkable. And yeah, there's some injury trouble there and stuff like that. But this was never a team that was going to be particularly good. And they might sell off some pieces before the deadline. And although, I don't know, with the way some of their vets are performing, if they sell off pieces, they might actually get better. Like if you take Andrew Benintendi out of that lineup every day, you're probably going to going to improve. It's bleak at this point. Davey, wanted to pivot off of the team-specific stuff, ask you about a couple of the recent things you've written. And I know you've continued to do work with some of the new bat tracking data we have. You did a pretty deep dive on Yandy Diaz that was interesting because of, I mean, he's a unique hitter type in general, but also when, and I think Davey's frozen there, so we might have to wait for him to get back here. Yeah. Okay. So Davey's frozen. Oh, he's back. All right.
I'm so sorry.
No, it happens, man. The Zoom era. So this piece about Yandy Diaz, you know, Yandy's such an interesting figure on his own. And then in looking at some of that bat speed and blast data and things like that, we learn a little bit comparatively about, say, of Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who, you know, all those batted ball metrics have kind of gone in the right direction again here as he's having a better part of the year. What did you learn diving deep on Yandy Diaz and what's gone wrong for him so far this year?
Well, so he's a really fascinating guy. I mean, he's such an outlier. And it's also, we have to keep in mind, he's way down from where he was, but he's still an above average bat.
Yes, still hitting season. 270 when the whole league's hitting 235.
Exactly. You know, so he's not having a bad season. It's just, when you look at the numbers, he's this outlier in these crazy ways. You know, he's sixth in blasts overall, which is when you both swing hard, your bat goes over 75 miles an hour, and you square the ball up. And so those are really what everyone's trying to do. But his problem is that he just, you know, they call him ground beef for a reason. He hits 60% of his blasts come on the ground. Like when, and it's not just that he's hitting hard ground balls. It's that compared to everybody else, he's hitting them straight into the ground. You know, like normally you don't really differentiate between a ground ball with a launch angle of -5 and a launch angle of -20. They're both not great. but he just pounds them straight into the ground so hard. And so it's crazy to see somebody hitting the ball so hard and being such an outlier. He also just has these crazy skills where he hits the ball as hard as anyone, but he also whiffs. The only person who whiffs less than him is Luis Arraez. Like people shouldn't be able to do what he does. It doesn't make sense. And yet, as long as he's hitting the ball into the ground like that, he's not going to have the kind of success that he should.
So blast is kind of a new-ish term. Like you said, it's a hard swing where you also square the ball up. So you basically, it's a way of trying to capture really good swings, right? And in going through the leaderboard there, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. also popped up there pretty high and pretty high in terms of blasts per fast swing. So when you swing hard, how often do you square it up? Now, Vlad's been an interesting guy with all of these new data points over the years because there were a couple seasons there where the expected results didn't line up with the real results. He was hitting the heck out of the ball. But, you know, whether launch angle or direction or spin on the ball and things like that, something wasn't always lining up. This is the first time now, and it wasn't true in the first couple weeks of the season, but this is the first time now, A, that kind of actual results and expected are lining up a little better, and B, those things are trending back in the right direction. He was on, you know, Robert Orr's damage rate, for example, from Baseball Prospectus, right, which tries to take all these things together. He was on a multi-year decline, and he started to pick it back up now. When you look at a stat like Blast, when you see him on those leaderboards with Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton and Yandy Diaz and guys like that, what does that tell you about where Vlad is right now and kind of, you know, the believability of him having his best season since 2021?
I mean, I definitely believe it. You also look at it because he's not as extreme as Diaz, but he has some of the same markers, you know, as you well know. You know, so he is seventh in baseball with 100 blasts. The league average is a 714 weighted on base average. When you hit a blast, that he's seventh in baseball with 100 blasts. Among guys with 30 blasts, he has a 662 weighted on base. That's 165th.
Okay.
So he's maybe some of that is luck and maybe some of that is hitting the ball on the ground, but it's not like he's getting unlucky now. So there's nothing that he's doing that I'm saying, oh, I don't believe he can sustain this. I think if anything, I think there's more in the tank.
Which is that's fun to hear, because it's been nice to see him certainly hit for average and be flirting with 300 again. Nice mm-hmm. to see the walks come back up and stuff like that. But it's been really nice to see some home runs lately, which right. is you know, usually what lets you know he's fully locked in there. So David, we've only got a couple minutes left, but in general, one of the things that we can do this point in the season, and I know you did a little bit in looking at Yandy, I've looked at it with George Springer, kind of turning things around.
Yes.
Bat tracking stuff, we can see month by month, right? Like we can't measure year by year. We don't know a lot yet, but what are you looking for as this kind of expands over the course of the season? We can see, you know, maybe ebbs and flows and changes.
Right. So there are a couple of things. There's so much that goes into bat tracking that it's sometimes a little hard to see a change month over month. The thing that I've started looking at is competitive swing percentage. So all a competitive swing is bat tracking. They can't track every single swing, in the sense that if you do a check swing or you're just trying to foul the ball off, they don't count that as far as your bat speed goes or a lot of other metrics. But it does give you a sense the competitive. So they give you the percentage of competitive swings, and what you can see is sort of how often somebody is really trying to do damage, how often they're trying to hit the ball. It's different from fast swing rate, because those are, you know, that's going to select for players who are just hitting for power. But so I was looking at competitive swing rate, and I was looking at the Jays, and I saw Bo Bichette. So here's April, 65%, May, 83%, June, 88%, July, 92%. And his numbers have kind of gone down there. So it seems like he's swinging harder lately, but it's the results aren't coming. You know, his whiffs are up. He's really struggling in June and July so far. So I think that's something to look for, is how often is somebody swinging out of their shoes? And does that mean they're seeing the ball well, or does that mean they're guessing and just trying to rip it a little more?
Yeah, it's interesting to see that. That's an interesting metric to kind of develop here and track over the next couple of months, but next couple years as well. It's NBA free agency still, by the way, and the odd Woj bomb comes out, but then it's like the most fizzled Woj bomb possible, and I'm like, do I have to do something Raptors? And it's no, absolutely I do not. All right, Davey, last one, man. I wanted to ask you more about the excellent what do we see when we watch baseball piece that you did. So for anyone who didn't see it at Fangraphs, Davey kind of erased the ball from a couple video clips and asked people, you know, hey, what do you notice, what do you see? This is a short window to answer this question, but how much do you think an experiment like that tells us about the way actual Major League Baseball players process baseball, and like that kind of brain chunking or mapping, where, you know, like a guy like Mookie Betts maybe can't explain to you what he's actually looking for at the plate, but our brains can fill in a lot of blanks that maybe we can't verbalize.
Right. I mean, I think it says less about batters and probably more about fielders. You know, I think there's and maybe base runners as well. There's so much, you know, if you're an outfielder, an infielder, and you're looking to see where the ball goes, you're reading the swing way more than you're reading the actual ball. You know, the kind of the piece was sort of about all the choreography that we're used to seeing in a baseball game, and that even if you take the ball out, just everything revolves around it in such a way that you're so used to it that you might not necessarily miss it. And so if you're an outfielder, if you're Kevin Kiermaier, who is famously can see the catcher's signs from center field, you know, you're reading swings and the ball, you're going to track it once it's hit, but you know which way you're going long before the ball has hit the bat, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating how our brains can kind of fill those gaps. I read a book years ago called The Psychology of Baseball that kind of looks at that stuff too. And like, it's not about psychology the way we think of it. It's like how our brain actually functions to put all those things together. Davey Andrews, got to let you go here, man. Show's over. Sorry, I was keeping you too long. Thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy.
All right, thanks for having me, Billy.
Davey Andrews of Fangraphs. Again, can't recommend enough going to check that piece out and, you know, reading some of people's reactions to, you know, hey, what happens when you take the ball out of the frame and you almost don't even notice at first? Is that kind of what fielders are seeing? Is that kind of, I mean, batters need to see the ball. But, you know, in terms of that pattern recognition and filling in blanks, pretty fascinating stuff. Also fascinating, seeing what Blake Snell looks like off the IL. The Jays will face him tonight. He had a 9.51 ERA over a bit of a stop and start to his season. That's only six starts. It's still Blake Snell. Probably not as good as the 2.25 ERA from last year, but still elite at getting swing and miss. Will get you with the curveball, the slider, and the changeup, swinging and missing. Justin Turner's 3-for-21 against him with eight strikeouts. George Springer's 5-for-20, but has homered against him. And Danny Jansen's 1-for-9. So not a lot of great Jays track record there. Yusei Kikuchi hasn't seen the Giants a ton, and it's mostly been Matt Chapman, who is 5-for-16 against him with a pair of home runs. Kikuchi a better outing last time. We'll see if he can continue to build on that. It's 9:45, Kikuchi against Snell. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it down for you and talk MLB draft. Thank you to Keegan Mathison, Jeff Ponce, Craig Goldstein, and Davey Andrews for joining us. Thank you to Andrew Adams, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass, especially for adjusting the backup studio for us here, since we couldn't use the main one. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Hope you all have a wonderful Tuesday.